You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Better Call Paul is a production of Lola Media. Say hi, Lola.
Hey, everyone. This is Paul Sarker from Better Call Paul. Just wanted to remind you that the show is intended for entertainment purposes only and is not legal advice. I am not your lawyer unless we separately agree for me to represent you, and the views expressed by Mesh and me are solely our own. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Better Call Paul, the show where we discuss the legal and business side behind the scenes of Hollywood sports and entertainment. I'm your co-host, Paul Sarker, former Marvel lawyer and current Big Law Media attorney.
And I'm your other co-host, Mesh Lakhani, founder Lola Media, season 4 watcher of Succession, which premiered over the weekend, and it was fantastic. Paul, I don't think, did you have a chance to watch it yet?
I have not. I spent the weekend, much like you do, in the nation's capital.
Oh, yeah.
Which is very exciting. Did the White House tour, did the Capitol tour, and it was inspiring. Saw the cherry blossoms, although when I was there, the weather wasn't great, but did not watch any TV or film this weekend, unfortunately.
Well, you know, that's probably a good thing. Get a little break. I mean, here's the thing about the DC thing is that cherry blossom seasons, traffic goes insane, plane tickets are insane, train tickets are insane, hotel prices are insane. I actually got here yesterday, and I've never paid so much for a train, and then the traffic it just took to get around, but it is pretty with the cherry blossoms around here, so I understand. That's great that you got to enjoy that-ish, kind of, given the weather.
Yeah, and actually the first day I got there was like 80 degrees, and then the next two were cold and rainy, so, you know, that's a little bit of a bummer, but, and the day we left, it was gorgeous, but we weren't there for that
thing. Nice. Well, good, good. Cherry blossoms are a special event in D.C., so at least you got to see some of it.
So what is it? Is a peak like 2 weeks long?
It's right around now for the next like 2-3 weeks.
Okay.
Even driving through the city, you notice it all around. You're like, oh, wow. It's pretty breathtaking.
Yeah.
It's very, very pretty. And I mean, I lived in D.C. for 7 years, so this was normal for me, and I didn't realize how many people travel here for it. So, but, you know. It's a good time. It just means that spring's around the corner. Weather's getting better. Same thing in New York. It was pretty rainy, but at least it's getting warmer. Spring season, right around the corner from summer season. And all the new shows, again, picking up. Like I said, Succession just started again. I've got a last season. It's very, very good for a first episode. So highly recommend when you get the time to catch up on it.
I actually have to finish season 3.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Finish season 3 to be ready for season 4.
So, Paul, our first story for today, we're going to talk about Sharon Stone, who was accepting a Courage Award from Women's Cancer Research Fund. She gave a really, really beautiful speech just about more research and money and donations that go towards cancer research and the support of breast cancer survivors. But there was some interesting, I wouldn't call it a twist, but in her speech, she was talking about how it's hard to give right now. It's a difficult time for people, but please write a check. She was even saying, quote, Sharon Stone said, I'm a technical idiot, but I can write an effing check. And right now—
Oh yeah, she couldn't do the text to donate, but she could write a check.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And she said, and right now, that's courage too, because I know what's happening. I just lost half my money in this banking thing, and that doesn't mean I'm not here, said Stone. And so she was referring to, at the time that her speech was given, the Silicon Valley banking collapse, which was, again, part of this like regional bank scare that's happening right now. And I thought it was interesting to bring it up for two reasons. One, I mean, something we can quickly talk about and And I know people have been reading about this in the news, but I was also curious like how it directly affected her. I mean, it could be for many, many reasons, but I could think about how she would be affected in that case.
It was a star-studded event. Maroon 5, I think, performed, closed the night, and she won the Courage Award. And she's, you know, she's dealt with a lot. I think she had cancer. I don't know if it was breast cancer or whether it was misdiagnosed. She lost her brother recently of heart disease.
And like that was like a couple of weeks before that she gave the speech that her brother just passed.
And she's like, you know, life goes on. We have to still be there. We have to support. We have to donate. I don't fully understand how she lost half her money. Maybe she owned SVB stock or something.
Not the only way. There's many ways you can lose money, but quick recap on what had happened. Silicon Valley Bank, which is a regional bank that focuses on the tech sector, directly like around these VC-backed startups, anything from starting a company to, you know, being multi-billion dollar companies. They were basically so concentrated in what they did. They took their money and they invested in these like long-dated bonds. And in the case of what they're trying to do, they need short-duration liquidity when people are trying to pull their money out. And in their case, with interest rates going up, the assets that they had bought, these long durations, like 10 years, the assets went down and they basically lost money on their balance sheet. And then they sold it.
Oh, because they bought bonds paying super low interest. And then when market rates go up to like 4 or 5%.
And so they took a loss on this. And this was just around the same time that there were a few people out there that were saying that the Silicon Valley balance sheet is not that healthy. So people were putting a short on the stock. And then it just like you had this capitulation. You had people being like, okay, well, if they don't have liquidity right now, let's take our money out and just like move it around. And then it just, you know, you had a fastball come in.
A run on the bank.
And especially like in tech world, like things get around pretty quickly. But at the end of the day, if you have your money with a bank and you're worried about liquidity, yeah, you're going to go somewhere else. And what ended up happening was everyone was worried that if you put your money in a bank and your deposits are not safe, even though they're FDIC insured up to $250,000. But for businesses, you're like, well, they didn't do anything.
Yeah, they could have hundreds of millions.
Exactly. Right? If the bank is doing bad asset management, which is a regulatory issue as well, let's move it. And so the scare was from the government stepping in and the Fed stepping in was really more around, well, if this regional bank gets screwed, what about all the other regional banks that everyone gets worried about? So you have like First Republic, you have, you know, I mean, there's Bank of Hawaii, and then a lot of these regional banks do commercial real estate lending. So that's actually the big scare. Anyways, that had a big effect on the banking sector. Obviously, the big banks were okay for the most part, like the JP Morgans of the world, but these regional banks were all like dropping 25, 40, 50%. So I'm wondering if she owned these banks directly, maybe in her portfolio, or maybe she was worried because she banked with one of them and she was a little bit worried about that. So that was a bit unclear.
The government did say that depositors, notwithstanding the $250,000 limit with FDIC insurance, would be fully protected, right? Yes. I don't know if what that, maybe there's the devil's in the details there.
No, you're right. If she's a depositor, she'd be totally fine. So it's really more like, does she own certain assets in her portfolio? And then maybe it was just like that week, everyone was a bit nervous, or maybe she's exposed to a lot of VC funds. Who knows what it is? Like, it could be anything, but from the depositor standpoint, she should be okay. But if she was directly invested in these like regional banks, yes, like she could potentially have lost 50% of her money if she was exposed in a large way, which would, you know, I'm just in my head, I'm thinking like, hopefully she's actually okay and it wasn't that big of an effect on her checkbook. Or maybe, who knows why she said that specifically. I was just curious when I saw the headline, I was like, you know, something to be brought up. It's so specific to say something like that in a speech, but you never know.
Yeah, and she said, interestingly, she said she made notes for her speech at that event, whereas normally she just goes up and sort of wings it.
Yeah,
so, yeah, hit home, hit close out. Well, hopefully everything works out for her. Listen, it's a tough time for a lot of people.
Yeah.
No one's really been spared, and good that she was still able to inspire people to donate. I'm actually on the board of a couple nonprofit organizations, and we have to raise money every year. And in times like this, it's just challenging, right? To get people to write a check when they're concerned about the economy and their jobs and whatever, but it's still important. It doesn't mean, you know, in recessions, that doesn't mean like the causes that we need to support go away or don't need money. It's just, it's maybe not as easy to fund them, but it's still as important.
Yeah, it's just a tough time, you know, in terms of the stock market, the economy, just generally fundraising environment. It's been very, very challenging for most people. So it's the right causes that she's speaking for. So again, hope everything's okay with her. And let's take a break and then let's come back and talk about a company that is not having those issues. If anything, it's the opposite, and they're doing extremely well. A24 Film Studio, we'll talk about it after the break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So as you said, A24 had crushed it this year. They won 9 Oscars between Everything Everywhere All at Once and The Whale. And they won all of the Best Actor awards, right? Because Brendan Fraser won Best Actor. And then the Best Actress, Michelle Yeoh, Best Supporting Actor, Ki-Hae Kwan, and Best Supporting Actress, Jamie Lee Curtis. So that was a really interesting thing. I don't know if an indie studio has ever done that.
Yeah.
But they were the most nominated studio. They were nominated for 18 Oscars. They won 9, which is just crazy.
That's great.
And the fact is they're a 10, 11-year-old company founded by 3 indie film / finance guys, David Finkel, Daniel Katz, John Hodges. John Hodges actually left in 2018. But there was an article that came out because they're notoriously tight-lipped. Like, they don't actually talk a lot about themselves.
Yeah.
They don't do a lot of press individually. But one of their investors, this venture capital firm Stripes, who actually has a really good track record, they've invested in like On Running, yeah, Levain Bakery, and Erewhon, and Gimlet. So, you know, they don't do a ton in the media space.
Yeah, they've got good taste.
They've got good taste, exactly.
You've seen On shoes everywhere.
They're great. Now, Jessica has some On boots, and she wore them like everywhere all the time because they were super comfortable and also supportive. And so Ken Fox is at Stripes, and he said that, you know, listen, they have great taste, obviously. And he said they're looking for companies in the consumer products, tech space, sometimes media, but they really are looking for diamonds in the rough, needles in the haystack, companies that are outperforming, that are admired and loved by their customers, and that are at their inflection points. And that's what A24 is. So a year ago, they put $225 million into A24, which I think they got around 10%. So the valuation was like around $2.5 billion.
Like $2.5 billion, yeah.
And that's crazy to think about an indie studio raising that much money. That was their first institutional investment. And so what this is really enabling them to do is expand. And so in the beginning, when they started, they were a film distribution company. So a lot of what they would do would be like they'd go to the festivals, they'd buy films that were up for sale, independently financed, and then they would distribute them and they'd put their logo on it. And so they were exercising a lot of their taste,
yeah,
right? Because they picked a lot of winners. But as they, you know, made money from the distribution, were starting to raise capital, built out their team, they started producing and funding films themselves. And so what they're building is really, I mean, it sounds like the goal, and we haven't talked to anyone directly, it seems like, according to this Deadline article, their goal is really to build a multifaceted international studio that also does other things like consumer products,
yeah,
perhaps a subscription service, gets into beauty products and audio, so podcasting, and really just they want to be like maybe not even an independent, right? Like they want to be a major.
Well, it seems like that it's like we get to witness firsthand like the growth of a studio to become like a big, big, you know, just like some of the studios that we've all seen, you know, from like Disney to Fox, et cetera. Like this is watching something in the last decade grow, and now they've got not only success, they've got money to be able to go and acquire, you know, potentially getting more into TV distribution and TV creation, to your point about merch. But they also have like a really, really loyal fan base. So fans just, when they see A24 now, it's kind of like the equivalent of like how Marvel fans would be like, a Marvel movie, let's go watch this. But with A24, it's like, oh, A24 is doing this. It's going to be good. And then they have a really good reputation when it comes to working with talent, like directors and actors and actresses. Everyone wants to work with them because they think about creative first. Now, we'll see what happens with that as you become a bigger studio. But just to list out some of these hits that they've had so people are aware, Moonlight, Hereditary, Lady Bird, Uncut Gems, Ex Machina, those are some of the movies that have done very, very well.
I mean, Minari, Last Black Man in San Francisco, yeah. The Farewell, as you said, Marcel the Shell. And then they also have TV. They have Euphoria, Rami.
Back to your point about consumer products, Euphoria, which is one of A24's show, makeup artist who is part of Euphoria, Donny Avi, launched Half Magic, which is a makeup line. And obviously, like, Euphoria has a really, really strong base amongst like young teens and like, you know, like older teens who, look, these guys make in the show the style, the fashion, the makeup, they follow this stuff. And I think they've been able to see that they could produce products out of these films and TV. And I think Euphoria is a good example of that.
Right. They spend, I don't know, maybe 15 to 20 million on their film. Some of them are bigger. I know they have an Alex Garland film, Civil War, which I think is going to be a $50 million budget. So their budgets are obviously getting bigger. They have more money. They've had a couple successes. You know, you win 9 Oscars, obviously you start taking larger bets. But it's really, I think maybe a sports analogy makes sense here because their growth and their success is not a result necessarily of some technological innovation. It's not like they invented some new way of distributing content, which enabled Netflix to really grow and raise money and just dominate. And it's not like they revolutionized like retail like Amazon did, right? They're just really good at picking winners. Yeah. And not every movie and every show they make is a success, but they've had so many successes. Yeah. On small budgets that, you know, now, as you said, fans start to associate that A24 logo with something that, you know, they're going to enjoy. So it's like they're building a brand. And it's funny because they're not really overdoing the franchise thing the way Hollywood is like, you know, making the 7th, 8th installment of the same movie because they don't want to take risk with trying out new material and it potentially not having a built-in fan base. So they're kind of the opposite. Like everything is unique. Now they're working with the same directors over and over, right? Because they, once you have a working relationship with the director and the casting and all that, with the Daniels, they did Swiss Army Man. And then that was their first project with him. Then Everything Everywhere All at Once. So they had a working relationship. They knew how the directors worked. They were comfortable working with them. But it's not like they're telling the same story over and over, which is a criticism that others 100%. Would have of the major studios.
Yeah, it's that the major studios don't take any risk. And like, it's like another sequel, another reboot, another, you know, another superhero movie. And in this case, to your point, these are all original movies that have just done incredibly well. And they're very, very entertaining. And they're fantastic. And I think now you can, it's almost like you can feel the momentum.
Well, so the sports analogy here is in baseball, you have large market teams that are spending $350 million in their payrolls, right? Like teams in major cities like New York, LA, San Diego. And then you have small market teams that might spend 10% of that. And, you know, like the Tampa Bay Rays. And it's when you see a small market team that's competitive year after year, it's because they're really good at scouting and identifying up and coming talent, people that are less expensive but still perform. And that's really what A24 is doing. So they might be spending, you know, a fraction of what these major studios are because they're able to sort of have creative freedom and identify things, and they're sort of tapping into the culture of the moment. And, you know, they have this brand, they're having a moment, clearly, like millennials love them. And, you know, not everything is a success, but they've had a high percentage of successes, starting with Moonlight.
Really. Yeah, starting with Moonlight, which from what I read was originally backed by Brad Pitt's Plan B.
Yeah.
That helped them with that movie. And Moonlight was one of that, you know, won the Oscar and it's changed the game for them. But, you know, these two guys, like David Finkel, Daniel Katz, there was a third founder as well, but who left who left in 2018. You know, they're like art house film executives got together. This is also a New York-based studio. I was reading this interesting article about how, you know, they're essentially outsiders to LA and Hollywood. And they are New York-based. They, even in their company, it's like, it's an open floor plan. Everyone works with each other. There's not like titles. Even when they think about marketing, marketing is given that they don't have these massive budgets, they try to think about marketing, guerrilla marketing, and like certain interesting ways to, you know, do things in a creative way that people are talking about. One of the examples was with Ex Machina during South By. They teamed up with Tinder, where Ava, who's the character in Ex Machina, you were like opening up Tinder, then you'd see her profile, and then it would take you to the trailer. And so, like, I think that's actually kind of cool. Like,
I mean, that's a little bit of a bait and switch, don't you think? But I guess it. I guess yeah. It's good marketing.
Yeah, it is. It is good marketing. I mean, and I would say this: if you've seen Ex Machina, you do not want to go on a date with Ava. She'd probably kill you. So it's probably better just to get the trailer there. But I'd say that, like, the taste thing. I think the important thing here is that while now they have bigger budgets, so they're going for bigger films and more TV stuff, and again, consumer products, like, will they be able to keep that like pace of not only doing things well from a taste standpoint, but from a talent standpoint? If people want to still work with them.
Well, they got Joaquin Phoenix is working with them.
They got a movie coming out with them.
Zac Efron, he's doing The Iron Claw. Pete Davidson and Orlando Bloom are going to be doing Wizards. So it seems like more and more people want to work with them.
Yeah, more and more people want to work with them.
Now it's, you got to be on an A24 film. Right.
Well, I think that goes again to, like, I was reading about Sofia Coppola, a director who's done two movies with them. She said, look, like, they're great to work with because they understand creative. They want to take risks. And I think from what we've seen of or heard of the stories in Hollywood, like, you know, risk is a big thing, and especially creative risk. So it's a nice balance that they have, and it's paying off. Like, all these movies to some degree are a little, like, they've got this certain vibe to them, right? Like The Lobster, Lady Bird, Hereditary, Moonlight, Uncut Gems. Obviously now,
Room,
Everything Everywhere All at Once was like, hey, we can be a big budget movie and still be a little like quirky, because that movie cost what, $25 million to make, and they made $108 million.
I wouldn't say 25 is a big budget. I mean, that's the thing. It's on the large side of, you know, indie for sure, but it would.
It's still small though. Is my point.
Yeah, it's still small, and that's the thing is like, when you don't have a lot of money, you can't really waste a lot of money.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, I don't want to keep harping on this Batgirl $90 million movie. Never even saw the light of day. They just tossed it in the trash because it was either bad or they didn't want to pay royalties or they wanted a tax write-off or whatever. You couldn't imagine A24, at least this iteration of A24, spending $90 million on a film and not releasing it, right?
Like, right.
I'm pretty confident if they spent $90 million on a film, it would be pretty good. And I think that's what the Stripes are saying. The whole team, right, has vision and they have that special sauce. And no one would invest in a movie business expecting every film to be a hit. That would just never happen.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can hit on 30% of them, you know, and Everything Everywhere All at Once was $25 million, but it made $108 million in box office plus the 7 Oscars. So like that's a resounding success, but others also have been. And Uncut Gems, for example, was pre-pandemic 2019. I don't know if it made that much money, but they had worked with the directors on Good Time, which is a Robert Pattinson movie. And then they go back with Uncut Gems. And this is a whole different side of Adam Sandler. And it was like a win-win for everyone. And call me crazy, but I don't think a major studio puts Adam Sandler in Uncut Gems. I just don't think they would make that creative decision because it's like, you know, they're so focused on staying in the box.
Yeah. No, agreed. And you know, one more, like, now that they have all this money, as well as like reading an article saying that they're cash flow positive, but now they have this like influx of capital that they make other acquisitions. They bought Cherry Lane Theater in New York for $10 million. Cherry Lane Theater is at the West Village, I believe. And I think it's an interesting thing.
Like, yeah, it's in the West Village.
The plan there is, you know, do they want all these people that they're working with? Are they going to be now supporting like off-Broadway plays, or who knows what they could be doing with that? But it's probably, again, going back to like this loyal fan base that they have and being close to like their fans and close to the street, having an ear to talent, you know, potentially what up and coming talent's coming through there. So that to me, that was an interesting acquisition.
Well, the other thing is, so, you know, in the television side, and it's changed dramatically over the past 10 years, but they're a 10-year-old company, which is like nothing in the lifespan of Hollywood. But I remember working, and there's so much hurry up and wait, right? Like, you hire a director, you get a script, a writer, you get it, you put together, you know, a treatment or whatever it is, you submit it to the studio, and then you wait. And maybe they they move forward with it. Maybe they don't. Maybe it goes nowhere. And you're sitting there waiting for like months and months and perhaps even years. And now they have the money to make their own stuff. And they also have the reputation where people are going to buy it. So for example, Apple, when they're launching Apple TV Plus, they did an output deal with A24 because they're like, we need to populate this thing with content. Yeah. Well, what's one way that we know we're going to, we're reasonably likely to ensure that we'll get good content? Let's do a deal with A24. Same thing with Showtime, right? So Everything Everywhere All at Once is now streaming on Showtime because they have a deal with A24.
That's sick. I like that a lot. Well, I'm excited to watch more of their movies and more of their shows. This was fun for us to do because I'm genuinely a fan. So it was fun to like go down this road and learn more about them. But Paul, let's take a break and then let's get back and we'll talk about Mr. Bad Bunny and some legal issues he's getting into.
So last week we talked about Tiger Woods got sued by his ex-girlfriend for $30 million for, I guess, kicking her out of the house and breaking an oral tenancy agreement. We'll see how that plays out. This week, another love story turned sour.
Yeah.
Bad Bunny's ex. It was actually a really nice romance. So according to what I was reading, they were dating in 2011 through 2016. They had to break up because she went to law school. But in the beginning of their relationship, you know, he was trying to get off the ground in his career. He was always making music, playing shows, and like working on songs. And he would run everything by her, and she would do his bookings. Her name is Carlys de la Cruz.
Yeah.
She's also from Puerto Rico. He asked her to record the phrase "Bad Bunny Baby," right? And she says it in a very cool, like, sultry voice.
Yeah.
She recorded it on her iPhone and sent it to him. And he placed that recording at the beginning of Pati and then also in Dos Mil 16, which was on Un Verano Sin Ti. Both of these songs have been streamed on Spotify over 200 million times, maybe 500 million in the aggregate.
Collectively,
viewed on YouTube maybe 50, 60, 100 million times. I don't know exactly. Necessarily.
Pati on YouTube is 355 million alone just on YouTube.
Well, I don't know if you've seen that video, but it got to 355 million in one last night. No, it's a good video. And Bad Bunny is an international superstar. This seems to me, so she's suing for $40 million because she's claiming that she never agreed to let him use the recording of her voice saying "Bad Bunny Baby." And I mean, the thing strikes me as a little bit opportunistic because now he's the number one or arguably number one international star. I guess he's up there with Ed Sheeran, Taylor Swift, The Weeknd, whatever, but he's a huge star. If she just made this recording on her iPhone and released it as a single, odds are it wouldn't have gotten 350 million streams or views. So, and they were dating and like, this is just like a half second clip. I mean, this is just my opinion, but it just seems like the fact that she filed a lawsuit and she's asking for $40 million in damages, I don't know if this is at all related to the fact that he's now been dating Kendall Jenner or has been seen with Kendall Jenner or whatever that is. That's a whole different
thing. He's in the press. He's constantly in the press now because of not only his music success, but now he's like, you know, it's more like Page Six type news with Kendall Jenner. And so maybe this is a good opportunity for her to get attention on this. Now, I have a different opinion on this. I think that if you're with someone for a long time, you're part of their career, you give them something that makes them, you know, throw them a couple bucks or like give them like a writing credit.
And we'll get into this. So just to get into the actual detail here. So Carlys de la Cruz is suing Bad Bunny, whose real name is Benito Martinez Ocasio. She's also suing his manager, Noah Camille Assad Byrne.
Right.
And she's suing his label, Rimas Entertainment, for the inclusion of those words in two songs. And she's saying as a result of the inclusion of those words, since then, she's gotten a lot of like attention and people have been commenting on our social media and she was never compensated. She never gave permission. There's no written agreement. But and she's also saying it's her recognizable voice. So she's trying to plead all the facts that would give you potentially a copyright infringement claim, potentially an unauthorized use of your likeness, violation of your right of publicity claim. And we'll see. So interestingly, I don't know if this is helpful or hurtful, probably not the best. Apparently someone from Bad Bunny's camp reached out to her the day before Un Verano Sin Ti was released. So last year, last spring, and offered her an agreement and a $2,000 payment to own the recording. She said no. She was probably, I'm assuming, insulted by the $2,000.
I'm insulted for her.
offer, given the fact that he is literally an enormous star.
Yeah.
And maybe the fact that it didn't come from him directly, like the request didn't come from him directly. But at some point, someone went through the clearances and they were like, do we have copyright? Do we have either permission right. or a license, or do we own the copyright in these words? And they said no. So they must have reached out and done a deal. Mm. Or maybe they said, we think we do, but we want to clarify it. It would be better if we had something written and signed than not. And so they tried to resolve the ambiguity or whatever. They tried to get the rights for $2,000. She said no. Boom. A year later, file the lawsuit.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I wonder now if they could be like, hey, we'll give you a writer's... Like, she probably was like, well, the song's been famous for a while. You know, it's not like you could give me a writer's credit now. Like, there's a whole backlog of royalties that have potentially been made on the song that I could have been a part of. Or they just re-record the song.
Well, so let's do the legal side. So basically, as we've discussed, so music has... Every song has two copyrights. They have the composition and then the master sound recording. So she's not claiming she has any ownership in the composition because she didn't write the song.
Right.
She didn't write that lyric. It's just Bad Bunny Baby. So like Bad Bunny actually told her to say that. But she's saying that she does own the copyright in the recording
right,
because it's her performance. And typically, I would tell any artist, anyone that is in the studio, anyone that's in the recording booth, anyone that contributes to that recording needs to sign something
right.
with your label, with you, so that you own the rights to the sound recording. Because otherwise this can happen. Because if you are on the sound recording and you haven't consented and you haven't entered into an agreement, then you could potentially block the release of that song. Question is, how important is she to the song? And if she had made a big deal about this before the song was released, he probably could have just re-recorded it or had someone else say it. And then, you know, you move on. And that's where they're getting the $2,000 number, because literally anyone right. could have said that line.
That makes sense. The
cat's out of the bag. The song's already been released. The songs have made a lot of money. So now they're potentially sweating out what the damages might be. I don't know. $40 million seems like a reach to
that
me,
seems
but
like
you're
a
at
reach.
Least getting to a point where someone like a judge or jury is going to think about what this is worth, which is why we always tell people, get it in writing, get the clearances before you spend a lot of money, because if something becomes a hit, then you can be held up, right? At you know.
I agree. I think like $40 million seems a bit outrageous. $200K for something like that. I don't know. That seems like round a number that makes sense for her. $2,000
pay
like
for her law
low.
School, like whatever. Yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
whatever.
He's got the money. But you know, now they're in this jump ball state where maybe they get to a judge or a jury and they have to prove actual. They could either prove actual damages. If that's not enough, then they could prove a potential of lost profits. Like if she wrote half the song, or if she was integral to the song, that could be potentially more damage. And then there's statutory damages, which I don't think will apply here because I don't think she's registered the copyright and I don't think the infringement was willful. But she could attempt to say that her words would have made all this money, or the song wouldn't have been a hit without her. But really, if you listen to the song, I mean, her part is just, it's really just the intro.
Sure.
It has nothing to
sure.
do with the actual song.
Yeah.
So it just seems like a very opportunistic suit, which is a real shame for Bad Bunny.
It is. And I know you're a Bad Bunny fan. So I think the lesson here, anyone who's getting involved in music, if you're doing a recording, as Paul said, get something in writing or get yourself a Paul. And Paul, as always, good breakdowns. This was a fun one. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast, folks. That's our show for this week. Apple, Spotify, wherever you choose to listen. Better Call Paul is produced and edited by Valentino Rivera and assistant producer Lisa Sanders. Have a great week.
Thanks, everyone.